Welcome to the New in Chess podcast. You're listening to a story from The Essential Sosonko, collected portraits and tales of a bygone chess era by Grandmaster Genna Sosonko. Since the 1980s, he has written extensively for New in Chess magazine. Sosonko's chess writings, rather than being technical, chronicle the lives of the former and current top players with whom he has crossed paths. Today's episode is about Lev Pologayevsky. As a late bloomer in his time, Pologayevsky peaked third place on the ranks in 1972 at the age of 37 and participated in four World Championship candidate tournaments. His approach to opening preparation was very thorough, and his book Grandmaster Preparation has become iconic in chess literature. Enjoy the stories in today's reading, narrated by professional voice actor Nick Murphy from The Essential Sosonko, Chapter 5, Lev Pologayevsky.
Lev Pologayevsky, 1934-1995. I must work. Pologayevsky? No, there's no such name, laughingly asserted a sun-tanned lady, a chance visitor to a chess tournament in the hot September of 1965. But my name really is Pologayevsky, in embarrassment, repeated Lyova. Footnote, Lyova, the diminutive form of Lev, end footnote. With his luxuriant head of hair, expressive black eyes underneath shaggy eyebrows, rapid-fire speech, and the almost tangible youthful energy of a 30-year-old, it was then that I first met Lyova. In that already distant 1965 autumn in Tsukumi, where we were playing in the Berevetsnik Championship, which was simultaneously a USSR Championship semi-final, although Lyova was already a recognised grandmaster, at that time only a very few were personally admitted into the final, and he, like practically everyone, had to begin from the semi-final. I was not even a master. The difference in class was enormous, and Lyova won trivially against me. The tournament was a long one, lasting nearly a whole month, and I remember not just individual games, but also the sea and the beach, where almost all the participants gathered during the day, and Lyova himself, who was sociable and friendly with those of us who were still very young, Albert, Gulko, myself. It is interesting that my last purely chess memories of him are also associated with the sea, the sun, and the beach. At Aruba in the spring of 1991, we both played matches with the Polga sisters, he with Judith and I with Sophia, and we saw each other almost every day for 3 weeks and talked much and about much. But of course, there were also numerous meetings at tournaments and Olympiads in Tilburg, Buenos Aires, Plovdiv, Vikenzee, Stockholm, Thessaloniki, at my place in Amsterdam, at his place in Paris, and finally in Monaco in April, a few months before the death of the outstanding grandmaster Lev Abramovich Pologayevsky. All who knew Lyova as a child remember a boy who was small for his age, incredibly thin, with rapid speech and lively black eyes. Spassky remarked, "The first time I saw Lyova was in Leningrad at the Junior Championships in 1949. I was 12 and Lyova was a couple of years older. At the time, I was very good at Shelbini. Footnote, a not very difficult game, the point of which is to flick the opponent's draftsman off the board with your index finger, end footnote. Then they brought Lyova Pologayevsky over to me, and he simply tore me apart at this game. A few days later, we played our first chess game. I began 1d4, Lyova applied 1f5, I played 2g4, and here such chaos ensued on the board that we became frightened, and within just a few moves agreed a draw. I can picture well Liova's beaming face after he had won one of his best-known games at the USSR Championship in Moscow in 1969 against Tal, when I was the second of the losing side. The variation that occurred in this game had been analysed by Misha and me earlier during our preparations for his match with Korshnoi, and, as it seemed to us, quite thoroughly. We did not examine in particular detail the position that arose after Black's 20th move. In fact, Black was a piece up. White's rook and knight were attacked, and there did not appear to be any direct threats. Liova, however, had analysed deeper. He found a continuation of the attack, and he won prettily. Geller later remembered that, on the evening before this game, he had dropped in at Polagiewski's room in the hotel and had seen some positions set out on the board. That same position was reached the following day in Liova's game against Tal on move 25. It turned out that when Spassky was preparing for his match with Petrosian, he, Geller and Liova had analysed this variation together, but Liova, in his analysis, had gone even further. It cannot be ruled out that, had Geller come to Liova's room 10 minutes later, he might have seen the position not after the 25th, but even after the 30th move, or even later. Here, two elements are reflected. On the one hand, Liova's remarkable analytical capabilities, his attempts to dig down to the truth, to calculate everything to the end, and on the other hand, a slight lack of self-confidence. This lack of self-confidence, combined with his excessive respect for the genuine giants of chess, and an overestimation of very many above whom he stood head and shoulders, was a hindrance to Liova throughout his chess career, and especially in his younger years. My most difficult opponent is myself. When I am playing, I often involuntarily make a world champion out of a candidate master, he himself once said. In his all-embracing opening research, Polagiewski, trying to reduce the role of chance to a minimum, went even further and deeper than Botvinnik. In the method of preparation and analysis adopted by present-day players, in particular by Kasparov, one can clearly observe the trend set by Polagiewski, a method in which the opponent is encircled by innovations, just like, as Furman expressed it, in winter hunting, wolves are encircled by flags. At the basis of this method of total opening preparation lies hard work. Where did this originate in Liova? Was this an individual trait? Was it implanted in his genes from the time when a poor Jew from the provinces, in order to study, or simply to live in St. Petersburg or Moscow, or to reach the percentage norm, needed all the time to demonstrate that he was better than others? Or should the explanation be sought more deeply? In the amazing lines of Osip Mandelstam, although it is quite insulting, you should know that there is fornication in work, and it is in our blood. To answer these questions is not easy. Liova left school with a gold medal. He studied in an arduous institute of technology, and for several years he combined his work as an engineer with chess. Who else of the fellow grandmasters of his generation and standard can say this about themselves? The basis of his chess victories, along with his outstanding talent, energy and drive, lay in his tireless analytical work. The famous Polagiewski notebooks, where he recorded the scrupulous results of his daytime and nighttime labour. Eyewitnesses relate how the very young Liova Polagiewski walked with outstretched arms and an impassioned gaze into the path of an already moving train in which he had left his notebooks. The fruits of many years of analysis. I won't let you pass! Many years later, in the spring of 1991, he found himself in a similar situation when he arrived in Amsterdam and discovered that he had left all his notebooks with analyses and research on the train. Scolding for appearances' sake his wife for her carelessness, he was annoyed, of course, but not all that much. Not all that much. I do not know, incidentally, if he managed to stop the train in the years of his youth, but the notebooks forgotten on the train to Amsterdam turned up safely within a month at the Lost Property Office, handed in by a guard who had found them. To him, these were figures, combined with an incomplete Latin alphabet, with strange pieces on diagrams and texts in an incomprehensible language. The notebooks of his formative years contain not only an enormous amount of analytical work, they are also full of mercilessly critical observations with regard to himself. My nerves let me down. I lacked self-control. I play badly in positions where something has to be sacrificed. I am poor at realizing an advantage. I get very nervous and experience cowardice when conducting attacks in unclear, double-edged positions. At almost all stages of one's chess development, such merciless self-reproach assists in the elimination of deficiencies and helps a player to improve, barring the very final stage, the battle for the title of world champion, when such criticism, emphasizing negative features, can be a hindrance to he who wishes to reach higher and become better than everyone. Among his diary recordings, there is also the following. I often end up in time trouble. Indeed, in his younger years, he was frequently in time trouble. This was, of course, the consequence of the same desire to calculate everything to the end, to find the only correct solution. But despite the sorrowful look from under the drooping eyebrows, his play in time trouble was normally strong. I remember that Osnos, a regular participant in USSR championships in the 60s, said, "The more sorrowful that Leova looks, the stronger and more deadly his moves." After he had passed 50, he became less successful playing under conditions of time shortage. He was terribly vexed by his oversights in Tilburg in 1985. "You can explain. You are an experienced trainer. Why? Why? I had problems with time trouble before, but why now? In every game, where does the time go?" I replied with a mild banality, "Leova, you will have heard that when you get older." Without allowing me to finish, he said heatedly, I know, but why me?" Sicilian Love is the name of his last book. From his childhood years, this defence entered Polugajewski's repertoire and remained, in various modifications, essentially his only weapon against 1e4. I will venture to give an explanation for this. I think that from the nature of his understanding of the game, where logic dominated, in the depths of his heart, he realized that the right of the first move gives a serious advantage. Therefore, the classical openings, in which black fights for gradual equality, seem to him tedious, and perhaps even dangerous. Hence, the Sicilian, an opening in which the centre is conceded, or more correctly given his name, it is semi-conceded, as in Russian, polu is a prefix meaning half or semi. The slightest mistake can have irreparable consequences. On the other hand, passive, insufficiently energetic play by white is also punished mercilessly. I cannot imagine Polugajewski playing the classical variations of the Ruy Lopez or defending a slightly inferior ending in the Petrov defence. He himself knew too well how to realise a slight advantage. An admission of Leova's profound knowledge in this opening was Fischer's first move, 1c4, in their only game, which was played in 1970 and ended in a draw. But Polugajewski is not only the Sicilian, and not only forcing variations. Still significant to this day are his monumental strategical concepts against the King's Indian defence, and how he played the Catalan, the Nimzo Indian and Retti's opening. In general, All the games with white won by Polugaevsky are as though baked out of the same dough, mixed out of a profound penetration into the position and the logic of this game. However, one cannot win numerous tournaments relying only on the opening. The list alone of tournaments that he won, or in which he at least finished in the first three, would occupy some 3 pages. Young players who came across Lev Polugaevsky in the last stage of his life, when he was already a spent force, in severe time trouble, sometimes blundering away pieces, leaving theory with white on the second or third move, and who think that he always played like that, should play through his games. Young players travelling from one open tournament to another, or even the heroes of Linares. Young players who, pressing a button on the keyboard, follow mainly the games of their contemporary opponents and calculate their rating after every game and every move, should play through the best games of Lev Polugaevsky. This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. DGT introduced digital clocks to the chess world at a time when only analog clocks were used. For over 30 years, DGT has been making the official FIDE chess clock, endorsed by the World Chess Federation. DGT clocks are the world's best-selling chess clocks, the standard in chess timing and used everywhere. To find your nearest DGT dealer, please visit our website at dgt.nl. Here is the testimony of people who knew him for many years. Vasily Smyslov.
I remember Lyova when he was still a teenager, and I knew him practically all his life. We and our families became friends, and we used to visit each other. Lyova was a pleasant and witty companion. In 1962 we played together in Mar del Plata, his first big international tournament, which he won. Already then I saw that he analysed brilliantly, simply brilliantly, and it was no accident that at the interzonal tournament in 1964 in Amsterdam, Lyova helped me. As a consultant, he was also superb. His thinking was very concrete. He was an excellent calculator and a player of outstanding talent. Recently I was playing in Prague, and I was playing badly. My score stood at -2. I knew that in Paris Lyova was seriously ill, but I did not imagine how seriously. I sent him a telegram wishing him health, and also wrote, "Dear Lyova, rescue me. I am playing badly. Help me." After this humble petition, I immediately won 2 games. For me, Lyova's death is a great personal loss. Even though in recent times he lived in Paris, we did not forget each other. Vladimir Bagirov.
I was Lyova's second for many years, and although I will state frankly that we had our disagreements in recent years, he was a grandiose chess player. For the fact that I am a grandmaster, and for my achievements in chess, I am greatly indebted to Lyova Polugaevsky.
Boris Spassky.
Lyova was somewhat overshadowed by others who pushed him into the background, but he understood chess better than many of those who achieved greater successes than he did. He understood chess so well because he analysed a great deal and penetrated exceptionally deeply into a position. After all, he continued developing and became stronger even after he was 40, reaching his peak between the ages of 45 and 47, when he achieved a harmony between calculation and intuition. In this way, he differs from me, for example, or Aliekhin or Capablanca, who quickly blossomed, but also rather quickly faded. In general, of the players of the same wave, Petrosian, Tal, Stein, myself, Korchnoi and Polugaevsky, the last two stand apart. They continue to develop, even after the age of 40. Thanks to their untiring analytical work, and Korchnoi reached his peak in Baguio, when he was already 47. I think that in the second match in Buenos Aires, Polugaevsky was no weaker than Korchnoi, perhaps even superior to him. But the whole match atmosphere, created by Korchnoi, had a depressing effect on Lyova. Also, as a trainer, he was splendid. Everything else was pushed aside, and there remained only his pure, subtle understanding of the game.
Viktor Korchnoi.
He and I had difficult relations. Yes, I do indeed have a big plus score against him. But there was a period from roughly 1960 till 1966 when Paul Gajewski regularly beat me. He was a striking player, and his name will undoubtedly remain in chess theory. He could have been a serious contender for the world championship had he not remained forever that same 15-year-old boy he was when he came into big-time chess. In Korchnoi's cruel words, there is a certain sense, but what could Lyova do if he did not have that malicious streak and hatred was alien to him? What could he do if, right to the end of his days, he did indeed retain a kind of childishness, a kind of naivety, together with a tinge of provinciality, mildness, unwillingness to offend, and good nature? Who knows? Perhaps the compensation for these qualities was the variation, his variation in the Sicilian defence, one of the most sharp, provocative, and risky. One has to agree with Spassky that the entire atmosphere at the Korchnoi-Pologaevsky match in Buenos Aires in 1980, the non-shaking of hands, the minor conflicts and clashes, all of this affected Pologaevsky to a much greater degree than his opponent. Korchnoi was accustomed to such an atmosphere from the time of his match with Petrosian in 1974, which for him was a kind of training ground for subsequent serious battles, more particularly those away from the board. Who knows how that match in Buenos Aires would have ended had the battle been fought only on the 64 squares. Lyova himself, however, was rather restrained when he talked about his chances in the battle for the title of world champion. As he pointed out in Sicilian Love, "Indeed, compared with other players, I do not have that killer instinct, the existence of which could have given a different turn to some of my matches, and who knows, I might possibly have achieved greater successes. There is no doubt that I do not have the character of a champion. I do not have the warlike nature of a Kasparov, a Karpov, or a Fischer. But, on the other hand, Erva, Smyslov, and Petrosian also lacked this destructive energy." Here it is hard not to agree with Pologaevsky. He indeed did not have the cold glance of Karpov thrusting the steel blade into his opponent, nor his way of analysing when, after a game, the search for truth is often replaced by a demonstration of his superiority, which had often already been evident during the game, but which he wanted to emphasise even more. There was not the I, with which every second sentence of Kasparov begins, or his analysis after a game with blows by the pieces on the board and at the ego of the opponent. There was also not that colossal, self-concentrated energy of Fischer, which so affected the opponent. But at those moments, when tournament fate pinned him to the wall, when only a win would suffice, he could both compose himself and play with amazing drive. The condolences of the participants in the 1973 Interzonal Tournament regarding the virtual impossibility of winning his game from the last round against Portish provoked in Lyova a cry of the heart. "If it comes to that, I've even won against world champions." And he won that game, with which his direct participation in the battle for the world championship began. In the West, I first met Pologaevsky in Holland, in Hilversum, in 1973. He was playing in the Avro tournament, in distinguished company. Jabot, Geller, Ivkov, the brilliant technician Anderson, the explosive multilingual Lubijevic, the young and dangerous tactician Sachs, and a thin, young man with long hair down to his shoulders, Timon. Lyova and I used to go for a walk after his games. We talked a lot, but very often it was a monologue by him, with questions thrown in from time to time. Sometimes Lyova, without waiting for my responses, would himself provide the reply. For me, who had already passed through the Donner School, this was nothing remarkable. We talked largely about life in the West.
I think that he himself realised when he moved to Paris in 1991 that these replies and the opinions formed did not always accord with reality. In these questions, he was as though weighing up, as did nearly every Soviet citizen, albeit contemplatively and theoretically. I wonder what would it be like if I were suddenly to find myself here. 20 years later, life, shuffling fates like cards, so that you never know how and where the trumps will turn up, transported him to Paris. This new life, with its different concepts, attitudes, and a new language, how difficult towards the end of your sixth decade, with its detested, definite and indefinite articles, devised by God knows whom and for what reason, did not attenuate the problems. They simply became different. During this period of almost two decades, I played about 10 games with Leova, losing one in Tilburg in 1983 and not winning once. Among the draws, there were several memorable games. One in Vinkovci in Yugoslavia in 1976, when I first made the Grandmaster Norm. By a miracle, I escaped with black. Another in Buenos Aires at the Olympiad in 1978, when, for the first time, the USSR team failed to win the gold medals. The Soviet team played Holland in the last round, and they needed to win by a big score in order to overtake the Hungarians, who were leading. I remember how nervous Leova was, both before the game and at the end of it, when I did not immediately agree to his offer of a draw. I know that he, who scored +5 on his board and played better than anyone in the Soviet team, was made one of the scapegoats after the lost Olympiad, as the second place of the USSR team was assessed at that time. This role of scapegoat was familiar to Leova from childhood, when he became the target of jests, banter, and practical jokes. Even his name, to say nothing of his surname, was played on by chess poets and journalists. Semi, semi-known, semi-grandmaster, and so on. The combination of Leova from Mogliova suggested itself, especially since it corresponded to his place of birth, Mogiliov. Of the amusing stories associated with him and practical jokes on the young Pologaevsky, his contemporary Gufeld could compile a small book. Often, Leova himself laughed along with everyone, but who knows whether he did not sometimes have the inner feeling of Gogol's Akaki Akakievich. Leave me alone. Why do you so offend me? I remember how, in Thessaloniki in 1984, during the Olympiad, he reached the age of 50. The day before, our six-hour game had ended in a draw. I don't understand, said Leova in surprise. How can I be 50? Just yesterday I was playing in the Russian Federation Junior Championship, and now suddenly I am 50. No, can you tell me how can this be? He did not understand that talent is essentially nothing other than the ability to find one's own destiny, and that he, Lev Pologaevsky, had found his destiny. In constant training sessions, preparations for semi-finals, finals, interzonal tournaments and candidates matches, and in problems relating to his family, flat, car and dacha, life had rushed on. In his immersion in life, in everyday concerns, he was, in his own way, a very down-to-earth person. Spassky remembers, in the 70s, we, and a whole group of grandmasters, were at a reception with Tierzelnikov. He spoke lengthily about the importance of our contribution to the building of communism, about our trips for this purpose. I don't recall what the others replied, but I immediately said that the building of communism was not for me, whereas Leova began asking something about expenses for the journey. In contrast to several of his colleagues, Pologaevsky was not a member of the party, and whenever joining the party was suggested, he preferred to keep quiet. In the mid-80s, at my home in Amsterdam, he picked up the record of a Russian bard who sang in the restaurants at Brighton Beach in New York and was fashionable in Moscow. "Do you like him?" I asked.
"Well, I don't know. It's a record everyone has in Moscow."
In Moscow, Lyova belonged to the circle that made it a rule not to be lagging behind, to be the first to have everything, whether it was a small transistor radio in the 60s or a video recorder, for example, much later, to the circle of people who travelled abroad and achieved success. Somewhere in the late 80s and early 90s, that same category of prestige began to include the ability to travel freely, not to emigrate, but to simply go abroad and take a look, to live for a while or send one's children to study. Lyova began spending long periods in Paris. After all, he had been bitten by the lure of foreign countries long before, and in 1991 he finally settled there. When he had passed away, I wondered, had it not been for the incredible pace and head-spinning gyration of Paris life, perhaps he would have still been alive. After all, longevity is in his family. Both his father and his mother easily passed their 8th decade. I suggested this very cautiously to Ira, his widow.
"What do you mean?" she replied. "Didn't you know Lyova? In Moscow he would have been even more unhappy."
It was difficult not to agree with her, since the formula, ubi bene, ibi patria, was in the end not thought up by him. One can hardly see him sitting quietly in Moscow or at the dacha while thinking that somewhere in New York, London, Paris, real life was going on without him. One involuntarily recalls the sigh of the old Socrates about a man who had returned from distant lands. How could he have changed if all the time he was dragging himself with him?
You love chess? Why don't you try New in Chess? With readers in 116 countries, New in Chess is the premier chess magazine in the world. What will you get? Exciting chess games explained by the best experts in a clear and accessible way, on-the-spot reports of the biggest events, top-notch instruction, independent journalism, chess history that comes to life, and great interviews. New in Chess, the way you want it. The beautifully produced paper edition, or the digital edition for phone, tablet, or PC. Give it a try. Go to our website, newinchess.com/magazine, for more information about subscriptions and special offers. After he moved to Paris, we quite often spoke on the telephone and sometimes saw each other. I remember a lengthy monologue of his about the fact that chess was completely different now, about its future and about computers. He said that the generation that had grown up without the computer found it very difficult to readjust, and that he himself used the computer only when preparing articles. That lengthy sessions with it leave you stale, stifle your play, cause fatigue, and deprive you of the freshness needed when playing. He thought that excessive working with computers was having an adverse effect on the play of Belyavsky and, to some extent, Yusupov. He was always full of ideas, sometimes cranky and unreal, but frequently they were logical and were later put into practice. When he spoke about them, he would keep asking, "Not bad. What do you think? Not bad, eh?" Few people know that both the tournament between veterans and the strongest women players and the famous tournaments in Monaco, held under the patronage of Joep van Oosterom, were largely his ideas. He himself began to play more rarely and less successfully. What told, of course, were his age and his new concerns, but, to an even greater extent, the illness which began with gaps in his memory and turned into a brain tumour. He once said to his wife during a tournament, "Do you know, Ira, I can't see the middle of the board." The operation, performed 18 months before he died, appeared to have been a success. He was regaining his health and making plans.
You know, in analysis, I'm already fine. I see a great deal, almost as well as before. But playing is still difficult.
I saw Lyova for the last time in Monaco, a few months before his death. The illness and the operation had removed the remaining hair on his head. Earlier, with a characteristic movement of both hands, he skillfully used camouflage with two or three strands his extensive bald patch. He quickly became tired, but his eyes and his smile were the same, and he happily sat following the games on the monitors in the tournament press centre. Perhaps his speech did not flow with such rapidity as earlier, and for the first time I heard from him, formerly so distant from religion, the words, God, belief, and I have never done anything bad to anyone in my life. When we parted, we embraced very warmly and agreed that at the first opportunity I would come to Paris to play a few training games, which would help him return to tournament play. I accidentally said to him, Proshai, a Russian word of portentous meaning, combining both the word of parting and simultaneously farewell and forgive me. Forgive me during our separation if I have in any way offended you. But already within a few days after his return to Paris, the symptoms appeared again. In the country where Lyova spent almost his entire life, traditionally doctors do not tell a patient about the hopelessness of his illness. It is also considered correct for his loved ones to hide the cruel truth from him. This was also the case with Lyova, who was told that it was a virus and that it should all pass over. Did he himself realize about the return of the terrible illness, which, in the majority of cases, signifies death itself? Of course, life is not always the longer the better, but death is always the longer the worse. It was the most subtle, amazing organ, the brain, that was affected, and Lev Pologievsky's death was a prolonged agony. This is from a splendid Russian writer who also died in Paris. It was an easy life, I asked of God. I should have asked for an easy death. At moments when he was lucid, he would cry, seeing his helplessness from the side and saying, Well now, I must work, I must work. He was very restless, and every morning he would take a sheet of paper, relating it to some imaginary facts, and would repeat again and again, Work, I must work. He once said to his nurses in the hospital, You know, I think that yesterday I didn't recognize my own wife. His nurses, who loved him and knew how to give him pleasure, began playing chess with each other. He laughed a great deal, watching their ridiculous moves, and repeating all the time in English, It's bad, it's bad. In the next stage of his illness, his slowly failing consciousness discarded other languages, English and the French that he had just about managed to learn, leaving just one, his native language. From his consciousness departed lots of things, his flat and insurance, francs and dollars, contracts and obligations, everything to which he had devoted masses of time and which seemed so important and pressing. He no longer had to be concerned about what they would say in the sports committee, in the federation, how and what to say or altogether to think something up. There remained only one thing. That game which had captivated that thin, 10-year-old lad with black, sparkling eyes in distant wartime Kubyshev. That ancient and marvellous game which had made his name known to millions. Chess had given him everything. The world which he had seen with his own eyes, material prosperity, fame, and finally the most important thing, the possibility of expressing himself. It did not give him old age. Not such a bad stage of human life, provided you do not know how it relates to the start.
I cannot, however, imagine Leova as an old man. After all, he died young. Since youth is not a stage in life, but rather a characteristic of the soul. His brain, impaired by the rapidly growing tumour, wove amazing associations, responding only to one stimulus, chess. A chessboard with pieces was always alongside his bed. Sometimes he would begin a game with an imaginary opponent. He would knit his brows, wrinkle his forehead, smooth his non-existent hair, and look searchingly sorrowful, assuming the chess facial expression familiar to all who ever played with him. At the very end, he could not even do this, and his wife, almost to the very last day, would tap the pieces on the board, provoking with their sounds wonderful associations that had forever entered into his soul. Suddenly, he would give descriptions of his grandmaster colleagues, which, in the words of his wife, were amazingly apt, although also merciless, expressing everything that had accumulated somewhere in the depths of his soul, but had never brought himself to say or write. He more than once said to his wife, "Korchnoi is my favourite player. You cannot even imagine what a colossal player he is." He did not change his opinion, however badly Korchnoi spoke or wrote about him, and he continued to greet him even when the other man used to turn aside. Not long before his death, when the remaining names had left even his subconscious, there remained one, which he would repeat in a whisper, "Korchnoi." And he would raise his thumb as a sign of his assessment of his play. On one of his very last days, his wife said, "You know, in 2 months' time, PK and Polga will be playing a match, and you will be Judith's second, and Korchnoi will be PK's, and in this way you will again play a match." This idea suddenly put him in a good mood, and he even cheered up and repeated, "Yes, we will play again. We will play." In psychology, the paradox is generally accepted that a hostage or victim may suddenly begin to experience warm feelings for his tormentor. Whether Leova had similar feelings with regard to Korchnoi, who twice stood in his path to the title of world champion, I do not know, and I would not venture to say. I cannot agree with Korchnoi's explanation that it was his painful conscience speaking out. According to Korchnoi, Leova had written erroneous reports for the Soviet press during his match with Karpov. I also do not think that he was giving vent to regrets regarding his lack of severity, which is almost a synonym for coarseness and tactlessness, abruptness, or what in the Soviet Union used to be called competitive malice. I think that it was simply a feeling of joyful wonder at what he himself had lacked in chess, the gambling element in this logical game, the sudden employment of a variation that the opponent was not expecting, perhaps not always correct, but one that would take him out of his normal state, the ability suddenly to change the character of the position and the resolution to say no, with your flag hanging in a double-edged position in reply to your opponent's offer of a draw. A few days later, when even these last visions left Leova, when chess departed, he himself departed. Lev Pologievsky died on August 30, 1995, in Paris, a city where other chess players who had been born in Russia also lived, Osip Bernstein, Svyeli Tartakova, Alexander Alyakin. He is buried, like Alyakin, at the Montparnasse Cemetery in Paris, and their graves are quite close.
This was a story from the book The Essential Sosunko. It is available at newinchess.com. A new podcast will be available every Friday on Spotify and Apple. Check out newinchess.com/podcast.